Production. Recorded live.
Hello, everyone. This is Carl Shinneman, Director of Legal Analytics and Review at Juranov, and welcome to another edition of ESI Bytes, where we offer information from national speakers on electronic discovery at a price everyone can afford, which is free, and available when they're interested in listening to it, or whenever you download it to whatever MP3 playing device you have, or iPod, or iPad, or anything like that, and you can listen to it when you want to. Today we have an excellent show, as we're going to look at the United Kingdom to get a sense of how e-discovery is handled there. This show almost happened last year on the 4th of July. You know, I had a little bit of humor on trying to schedule this when a international ESI Bytes listener contacted me about reposting some of the shows, and we talked about doing a show, and then it sort of fell by the wayside. Last week, I resurrected the idea, and our panelist, Chris Dale, came extremely highly recommended from the person that contacted me to talk about the English system of e-discovery, which is more of e-disclosure. Personally, I have fond memories from 1985 through 1986 when I was an exchange student at a university in England. I recall seeing publications like The Socialist Worker and seeing a lot more in the way of strikes than we see in the U.S., and I always found this amusing. And I also recall getting sick in England and visiting a doctor there for free. And all in all, there really are lots of differences between England and the U.S., so I'm not surprised that the English follow a different system of litigation. And given the challenges e-discovery faces in the United States and even the recent Duke conference where additional rules are being proposed to help improve e-discovery, I thought it would be interesting to look closer at the UK system for e-discovery advice, and maybe we can learn from each other. Given a world of multinationals, it's also obviously something which U.S. lawyers can benefit from being exposed to, so why not cover it? Our panelist, Chris Dale, qualified as an English solicitor in 1980 after reading history at Oxford. He was a litigation partner in London and then a litigation software developer and a litigation support consultant before turning to commentary on electronic discovery and disclosure. He runs the eDisclosure Information Project, which disseminates information about the court rules, problems, and the technology to lawyers and their clients, to judges, and to suppliers. He's a member of the Senior Master Whitaker's Working Party, which drafted the New Practice Direction and Electronic Comments Questionnaire. He writes the UK's only authoritative and objective website and blog on the subject, and is a well-known speaker and commentator in the UK, the US, and other common law jurisdictions. Chris, thanks for joining us on the show.
And, pleasure.
First of all, how did you become interested in electronic discovery?
Many years ago, as a litigator, I had a case that involved a large number of documents. There was then no system in existence. The PC was a new concept. So I went out and bought a PC, bought some database software, taught myself how to use it, and built an application. That was many years ago, and I subsequently became a stopped being a lawyer and became a litigation software developer, and that led in turn to what I do now.
Well, is litigation as big in the UK as it is in the United States?
No, not in the same way. It's not that litigation isn't a very important component of commercial and personal life, but we don't litigate for a hobby as they seem to in the US. Nor do we we don't make such a big meal of it, of many aspects of it, as seems to be the case in the US. I think it's worth just going back over the distinction between disclosure and discovery, as if there, which you mentioned as if there were a distinction. There isn't really. We used to call it discovery until 1999, when for no good reason the powers that be decided to rename it disclosure. The principles are exactly the same, or broadly the same anyway, that documents, electronic or otherwise, are the primary source of evidence. And that's where you look to inform the judge about the facts and people's states of mind. But there are many differences, which I can go through if you like, but the broad concept is the same as your discovery.
Well, that leads right into sort of the procedural framework for e-discovery or e-disclosure in the UK. Can you walk us through how this would happen in a typical case?
The first big difference between the UK and the US is that we don't wait for a request. We have a concept called standard disclosure. And standard disclosure involves each party giving voluntarily, i.e. making its own selection of the documents which it ought to disclose. The test for that is not relevance, the broad test of relevance which most people have. It's a narrower test where you produce documents that you've referred to in your pleadings or documents that support your case, documents that are against your case, and documents that are supportive or adverse to any other party's case. So that's the first big difference. We don't therefore have too much in the way of preliminary skirmishing about what the scope is. That's for the lawyer to decide. There may be arguments about it afterwards, but it's for the lawyers to decide. I'll come on in a minute to more recent developments in that, but broadly each party puts up its list, and we have a list here. The list is the primary thing which is disclosed rather than the documents. That changes, obviously, as documents become electronic, and now there's much more of a focus, despite the formal requirement for a list, there's much more focus on the documents themselves. The procedural framework which has changed is that, and this comes on, I think, to one of your future questions, but it's worth taking here, is that since 2005, we have had an obligation on parties to discuss their sources, to discuss the keywords they're proposing to use, and to discuss formats for exchange. And no one has taken any notice of that obligation at all. So in terms of, it's not been treated, therefore, as part of the procedure that people ought to follow. That has been changed, and in a new practice direction, which came out on the 1st of October. And that practice direction, firstly, is more prominently placed in the rules than the previous one. And secondly, is more directive in its language. The old one appeared to make it optional. And parties are now required to discuss their sources. They are required expressly to cooperate. And the upshot, the next procedural stage, to revert to your question, is a case management conference. At the case management conference, present their of what they're going to disclose. They present a sheet of paper showing what they've agreed with their opponents and another sheet showing what they've disagreed with their opponents. And as a result of that, the judge is supposed to decide the scope of disclosure. Thereafter, they go on and review according to what has been decided at the case management conference.
So, the meet and confer process, it was sort of recognized that it sounds like that there are real challenges on, you know, when you have ESI of trying to figure out what you need to pull out, right? I mean, was it the same tension that we have in the U.S. system of there's so much of it?
Yeah.
Where do we start? What are we going to miss?
Yeah, there is, of course, that tension. There's talking of tension, there are two things pulling in opposite directions. One is that many feel it their obligation to read every document that is potentially relevant, which clearly isn't practical. The other is that many of them think that the disclosure of electronic documents is optional. And within the last year, we've had a party turning up to the court and saying, we don't intend to disclose electronic documents. It's not proportionate that we should do so, as if they can ignore whole swathes of documents. Clearly, that's on, but not on as an approach. What the judge said in that case, which is a case called Goodale against the Ministry of Justice, is in many ways a template for how judges could and should be managing cases, and it's a very different approach from the US one. The US concept broadly is that you get your arms around everything that is potentially discoverable and work inwards from there. The approach outlined in Goodale was the opposite. Start with those people who are identified as being important, the date ranges that are important, and any other criteria that you may think relevant to deciding what's important. And give disclosure of those working outwards thereafter if you need to. And that is if we can make that catch on as a way of things, we could cut down drastically the amount of unnecessary disclosure. Clearly, it's required of parties that they have preserved the documents that they've got that might be called in due course. And clearly, you're not let off going down that route from disclosing the existence of sources. But what we're trying to work towards is a distinction between being upfront about the existence of things and actually throwing them into the ring for everybody to have to deal with. So the duty of candor is not mitigated in any sense by this approach.
Chris, I'm considering moving to England because I've been pitching a process which I call think before process, which sounds very similar to the findings in this Goodale case, where you look at your key custodians and put that information into, you know, a conceptual type of software to get fact patterns and pretend you don't even have a tool. Because the process is what's killing everyone. It's
that's precisely so. That's entirely in line with something I said, for example, at the Masters Conference in Washington last month, which is that the most important piece of technology you have lies between your ears.
Yeah.
And the starting point is old-fashioned lawyerly thinking about what's important, as it was in the days when the client handed you a slim file of those things that he decided were important. As I put it earlier, worked outwards from there. There's a battle to try and persuade people that that is not only something they can do in the rules, because not everybody accepts that that is permitted by the rules, but that it's a useful and helpful and proportionate way. And it's that word proportionality which is the key driver here. The balance of value against cost, which ought to allow people to decide what comes first.
And you know, from what I'm hearing, one of the struggles of trying to decide, even should you produce ESI, is the challenges that electronic data present for everyone, regardless of the system. So it sounds like your model still has lots of challenges, just like we're facing over here, but you're not approaching it as adversarial and as trying to grab everything up front.
That is so. One of the key differences is that we don't have sanctions in the sense that you understand them. In the broad use of the term, one can be punished, sanctioned by a costs penalty, which equates to the costs that you have caused the other side to lose. But that is a redistributive point, not a punishment point. So you don't get sanctions that are calculated as to hit you over the head because you've done things the wrong way. That doesn't let people off the proper duty to not to suppress things. It doesn't allow people to hide things, but it means that we are relatively free from the idea that you must collect everything just in case you get sanctioned for missing something, which I see as a negative driver in the US. So it's not that we're any less adversarial over the issues, but there's a primary obligation to be cooperative over the mechanics of disclosure.
The interesting discussion threads that came out of a similar podcast I did with some Canadian experts on e-discovery was whether or not they would ever have a spoliation case with one side not producing enough relevant ESI because maybe they had email archiving systems automatically deleting, you know, and they didn't stop the deleting. In England, and in that podcast, it was very interesting because the judge who was on the panel didn't think it would be possible, but the lawyer said, "Oh, it's very possible because we're still struggling with systems." How do you deal with that same problem in England if you're starting narrowly and moving outward with systems possibly getting rid of data?
Well, firstly, the point I made earlier about the distinction between disclosing the existence of things and actually throwing them into the ring is relevant here. So you're not let off disclosing that you've got systems. Our new practice direction has in it a paragraph which is expressly warns the lawyers to warn their clients to stop, for example, automated document destruction systems. That paragraph doesn't create a new duty of legal hold. We don't have, in the same way as you do, a formal duty of legal hold. But it does remind them that you now, these days, you need affirmative action to prevent the destruction of documents. The test here over documents generally is whether a fair trial can be conducted in the absence of that which existed but doesn't now. And to some extent, blame for the failure comes into it. But we don't try and slice the how negligent was this? Was it gross negligence, or was it just negligence, or was it merely carelessness in the way that the US authorities seem to do? As it happens, we've had very recently a case involving what was clearly deliberate destruction of data. And it was deliberate after an order for delivery up of computers. So we don't need to debate whether there can be a fair trial. We don't need to debate whether anything approaching a legal hold had arisen. There was an order that they hand over the computers, and they deleted data before they handed them over. Clear case for striking out, and that is what happened.
Question I was going to ask at the end of the show, but changed my mind, is why don't we sort of wind out the e-discovery area? Since you're a technologist, what do you see as the tolerance for trying new technologies in the English system, such as conceptual searching and predictive coding? Because we're having a heck of a discussion here in the U.S. on whether this makes sense and can it be relied upon.
Those are two separate questions, isn't it? Does it make sense and can they be relied upon?
This is a jazz freeform show, okay? So handle however you want.
Does it make sense? Clearly, some of this technology is magical, near magical in its qualities. The ability to seed a large document population with documents that a subject matter expert has decided are relevant or not relevant, and to have that go off and code the rest or mark the rest consistently with what the subject matter expert has decided over the first 1,000 or two. That is wonderful stuff. It's only as good, I don't think there's too much argument, frankly, about the quality of most of the technology that's there. The defect tends to be in how it's used, and more than that, in whether the lawyers doing it have adequately involved their opponents in what they're doing. Because there's no difference really between using such a system without cooperation and using your own choice of keywords without discussing them with the other side. There's another element to this. Is it a good enough way of doing things? Well, firstly, manual review is not the gold standard that everybody seems to think it is. The technology will work consistently from Monday to Friday, before and after lunch. No humans will, never mind the difference between one human.
It's the gold standard if you're being paid for it.
yes. You're even more cynical than I am. Your question wasn't about the profitability of law firms. Your question was about whether the courts will accept that it is proper, as they might put it, to delegate part of the process to technology. That same case I mentioned earlier, Goodale against the Ministry of Justice, is authority, if one needed authority, for the idea that some of the technology that's out there is not merely unacceptable, but the only realistic way of reducing volumes to a level that make it practicable and proportionate to handle them. The real key lies in the extent to which you involve your opponents, and if necessary the court, in what you are doing and what QA you have around it, what facilities the technology offers, for example, for you to sample that which has emerged as relevant and that which has emerged as irrelevant, and to go back over it and draw different conclusions on a second pass. That makes a radical difference, because that makes it defensible. Not that the word defensible is used as much over here as it is in the US, but that's really what we're talking about.
Yep. Yeah, it's that opinion, I'd certainly like to see that opinion, and we'll talk more about that after the show. Is even with that opinion, do you still see lots of educational hurdles in England with trying to educate various solicitors and judges that this is an appropriate way to take a pass at data and try to find what's relevant?
Yes, there's certainly much work to do. We had a report during last year from Lord Justice Jackson on the whole of litigation costs, and he devoted a chunk of that to electronic disclosure. And his only recommendation, only formal recommendation, was that there be significant training for judges and for lawyers. Where that's going to come from, save by, as it were, volunteers from like me, or from suppliers, or from some law firms, is hard to say. There's no formal structure for it in judicial training, for example. We don't have the same level of sophistication for judicial training that you have, and this is not necessarily going to be treated as a priority. One line to take on that is to use the lawyers as well as the suppliers as the trainers. Judges are clever people. They spent their lives picking up new ideas very quickly. And if one can get the lawyers to get better at the explanations, then the judges, I think, will pick it up very quickly. The route to the lawyers is a mixture of carrot and stick. One is the stick that they could find themselves named in one of the many judgments we've had over the last year, where individuals, as well as their firms and their clients, have been named and shamed. And that's a pretty compelling route, improving one's procedures. The other, which I prefer, is to emphasize the carrot aspect, that there's work to be won here by those who show themselves proficient at it. And those two things together, it'll take a long time, but those two things together, I think, will alter the way that the lawyers consider this. One fundamental and straightforward step they could take is, instead of simply asserting that electronic disclosure is too expensive, they could actually ring somebody up and find out what the costs might be. That would be a pretty good start.
Yes, I agree. That's all very interesting on e-discovery. I might as well round out the show. Just a couple quick questions on the differences for the multinationals listening on privacy and how you would handle a case in England if you were a U.S.-based multinational. First of all, you've got much stronger privacy laws in England, correct?
Yes, they're no different. They are different in detail, but the principle is the same for the whole EU, that the privacy of your data is a fundamental human right, and that which has deep historic roots and is not to be lightly cast aside. That generates a set of hurdles, as other countries see it, particularly the US, who don't have the same deep-rooted attachment to privacy and to data protection, and for whom the order of an American court is supreme. It comes as a surprise to many American lawyers to discover that not everybody has that same attitude to the order of an American court. And some of these things are insuperable, I suspect, but not all of them. Some of the issues arise because of a complete lack of understanding by both sides of what pressures exist on the other. American lawyers often actually arrive ready to collect their data without having applied their minds at all, or even become aware of the fact that there is a privacy hurdle here. Similarly, the EU could do more, I think, to recognize that, for example, European companies or European companies with sister or parent companies in the US who wish to engage in US commercial litigation must, to some extent, play to the same rules as everybody else. That is easily seen as insuperable, and it certainly is if both sides approach the problem as if theirs is the only position to take.
Well, it seems like your framework works real well with starting a case more narrowly. It's easier not to trample on privacy concerns if you're starting with more limited documents and working outward, as opposed to trying to grab everything and then work inward.
Yes, I was at a conference in Toronto a little while ago where one of the points made was the narrower you make the original ambit of your discovery, the less work there has to be done, for example, in identifying and then redacting, if necessary, private information. If you can reduce the pile before you've even started, that whole very high element of cost, and the same applies to privilege, for example, the smaller the pile, the less anybody's going to have to do, which has to be a good thing except for those who are driven entirely by the number of associate hours they can drag out of their associates.
Now, I've slipped into my old living in England mode where it's easy to take shots at the U.S. when you're talking to English people, but the fact of the matter is there are some good things in the U.S. system. We've already talked about the meet and confer process. Is there an interest in looking back and forth at various systems, such as the U.S., for ideas or aspects of subject matter expertise, is your system really going down its own path?
No, absolutely. There is scope for exchange of ideas, and that is a summary, effectively, of my mission in life. I don't want to be understood to be critical of the U.S. system, because the U.S. system has a lot of good ideas in it. I have been instrumental in bringing Judge Fatchier and Judge Grimm and Judge Laporte over here to speak on panels, not to tell us what to do, as American judges used to be asked to come and do, but to debate with our own judges the respective merits of the merits of our respective systems and the ways in which we might learn from each other. I did a panel at the Masters Conference in October where I had an Australian and an English judge talking about what we are doing in the non-US common law jurisdictions, with absolutely no intent to suggest that we have better ideas, still less that we execute on our ideas, because one of our big problems is the gap between what our rules say and how people actually behave. We are wholly committed, and when I say we, there's a small band of us, including a couple of judges, who are as international in our outlook as could be. This year, Master Whitaker and I have been in the US more than once. We've been in Singapore, we've been in Hong Kong, we've been in Sydney. And in all those places, we both drop our own ideas and pick up other people's ideas with a view to arriving at a synthesis of those things which work and those things which don't. And we may not appreciate everything that everybody else does, but every jurisdiction is applying their minds to it, and we ought to pool our knowledge and our understanding of that.
Well, this has been a very interesting show, Chris. I appreciate the discussion, and it's interesting how Justice Facciola was the first speaker on a podcast here and helped me get the ESI Bites started. And Judge Grimm has been very active. He's done about a half dozen shows. So it's nice to see sort of a common thread around the world on trying to struggle with these issues. So I've really enjoyed doing the show with you.
And I with you. Thank you.
Looking forward, thanks for joining us on ESI Bites, Chris, and hopefully we'll be able to do more shows with you later in the year. And To the listeners, if you've enjoyed this podcast, I'd encourage you to go to www.esibytes.com for a complete list of our show. You can also remember the show and website phonetically, as it sounds out as Easy Bytes of ESI information. So however you choose to remember us, come to ESI Bytes to learn more about eDiscovery before ESI bites you back. This is Carl Shinneman, Director of Legal Analytics and Review from Jurnov, wishing you a nice day.